The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. It is 4 minutes past nine, just turned on this Monday, the 27th of April, 2026. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. And it's great to have you on board for the show for today and for the week. We've got a packed show, as always, keeping you across all the big stories. We have lots lined up. But if there's anything you want to talk about, maybe something you want to bring to our attention from the weekend, let us know. 086 60 25,000. That is your WhatsApp and your text number. 086 60 25,000. It's not a club, by the way. It's not exclusive. If you have anything to say, just text that number. You don't have to have ever texted a radio station or this show before. We value your opinions, whether they're regular or brand new. It doesn't really matter. 07491 25,000. We still do the human stuff. We have people answering the call, or two people as close to human as we can possibly get. That's Caroline Orr and Shannon Wilkin. They're on the phones today, as always. Caroline, researcher and producer of the show. And you can email the show, comments at highlandradio.com. And if it is your will and it suits you, maybe you work in the home or from the home, you can watch us on your big screen, if it's a smart TV, which most are now, or your Fire Stick. Just open up the YouTube app, Highland Radio Ireland, and we're across the Facebook pages as well. Right, okay, lots to discuss. Lots coming up. What a weekend of sport, depending on what sport you like. What a shocker yesterday. Donegal beaten. Jim McGuinness's second only defeat in the Ulster Championship. Were we playing checkers or draughts and they were playing chess? Well, we'll find out from Brendan Devaney a little later on. And I want to focus perhaps maybe on how good the opposition was, rather than try and pick faults maybe in the Donegal set up and performance, because I think sometimes you are beaten by the better team on the day. But what do you think? We discuss all things on this show, including sport. So if that is what you want to talk about, I'll talk about that a little later on. I'll read what the Nationals are saying about that, because we can sort of have a local focus on it. It'll be interesting to see what the national newspapers, how they reflect on that game. Let's start with the news, though. The Dairy People, Donegal News. The ongoing fuel and cost of living crisis will dominate the agenda at a special plenary meeting of Donegal County Council in Lifford today. The special meeting takes place after calls from 100% Redress Party member councillors Thomas Sean Devine in light of the recent fuel protests. He wrote to both the chief executive of the council, John McLaughlin, and the Cathaoirleach councillor Paul Canning, demanding that a special meeting of the council takes place. Today's meeting comes after Sinn Féin spokesperson on finance, Piers Doherty, called on government to introduce an emergency budget to tackle the cost of living crisis, which goes broader than fuel. I note this morning diesel 188, 189, I think I saw it. Petrol, obviously, 10 cent odd lower. So that government intervention did work. Because if you compare what the crude oil prices are now compared to when fuel was around about the price it is now, there's a big gap. It's much higher now. So those interventions did work on the fuel. Many will argue not enough, but they are having an impact. But anyway, we'll be tracking, obviously, the newsroom will be tracking that meeting today to see what comes from it. I mean, it's nice that they all get together and have a conversation about it, but we know none of the decisions that really influence our lives in that regard are made at county council level. But it is good that they're talking about it, of course. The Dairy News, local businesses that donated 7 speed indicator devices for the Strathfoyle area have been praised. Speaking at the unveiling of the speed indicator devices in Rohan DEA, Councillor Declan Norris said the traffic calming measures could not have been installed without the generosity of the Lycra company, Eviro Energy, and Even More Energy. On my travels over the week, I think it was through Northern Ireland, I saw a little, it was like the size of a small generator with with an extension and a screen of sorts on it. And it was a speed detecting yoke. Now, it was obviously commissioned by the community because it was mobile. But I thought it was very interesting. You know, some of the places that we talk about with speed issues and we're waiting on local authorities or the TII or whomever it is to do something about it. And these little machines, obviously you can hire them. But the little mobile speed camera devices, and what happens is if you're doing in excess of 50, for an example, it's flashing red and saying, please slow down. And if you do, it says thank you. And I'm just thinking, you know, maybe it's time local communities start take things into their own hands. I don't know who hires these things out. They're not massive, right? They have a small footprint. But is that the solution? That, you know, I've often said in this show, things happen when the community sort of start doing stuff themselves, because we can't always rely on those that are paid to do it, right? I just saw this and I thought, right, I can think of a couple of places where we discuss that it'd be very interesting to see if the community hired one of these yokes, wherever you might get them, and if it had a positive impact and maybe sends a message to TII, local authority, or wherever. Former TD, this is in the Irish Daily Mail now, we'll go to the Nationals. Former TD Jim Glennon has revealed, or was revealed, he revealed himself last night as the person who gave a character reference for a man convicted of sexually exploiting a boy. Now all parties should do an audit of their TD's record of providing character references in criminal trials, Aint Do Leader Pada Tobin has said. Referring to how the former Fianna Fáil TD gave a reference to a disgraced former government advisor, Mr. Tobin told the Irish Daily Mail, such court references should be registered by parties and put on public record. Or you should have to go in to court. A lot of people in the legal space say that these character references don't have much bearing on the outcome of a sentencing or whatever it might be. Well, if they don't, scrap them altogether. But if they do, you should be obliged to go into court, right, and face cross-examination on what you're saying. So if a TD or whoever it might be, or if it were I, though I never would, if I wanted to give a character reference for someone, I should have to go into that court and be cross-examined on that character reference, you know, really to test the veracity of it. Because, you know, are people doing favours for friends saying, listen, you couldn't give this guy, he made a mistake, he's a good fella, you couldn't give him a character reference, could you? And they go, well, I'll do it for you. Well, it shouldn't work like that, because there are victims here. Everyone's entitled to a fair trial, but also victims are entitled to a fair trial as well. And I think if you are going to give a character reference, you should have to stand up in the court, put your hand on the Bible and swear that that is the case. And if cross-examination, you know, be cross-examined on it or challenged on it if need be. And I'll tell you one thing, you'd see some fall off on these character references. But anyway, this is what Tobin said. It's a shocking misuse of public office, and it is incredible that a number of parties have been asked if their TD is the one involved, and they've not been able to answer yes or no. Now, it's not going to be hard for Pádraig Tobin to poll his TDs, because they aren't that great in number. But that's what the opposition is for, I suppose. But what is your feelings on character reference? Maybe you believe they are an important part of the system. But, I mean, how can you give a character reference and say someone is a decent enough fella if they've been convicted of sexually exploiting a boy? Should they be gone away with altogether? Do you think they should stay as they are? Or, as I suggest, should you have to go into court and, you know, put your hand on a Bible or whatever you have to do under oath and say, no, this is why I believe this person is decent. The Irish Times this morning. The government is exploring one-off payments towards environmentally friendly energy measures like heat pumps and efficient cars amid the increasing political pressure of the global energy crisis. Minister for Finance Simon Harris has doubled down on a transition from fossil fuels, even as the government faces mounting calls to abandon its commitment to the carbon tax. Harris has now asked officials in his department to consider payments that could be made available towards the structural costs of changing to more sustainable energy and electricity supplies. Options now being considered include accessible financing for home upgrades and more access to retrofitting. I mean, it has to be done right, though, if they're going down this route. And listen, the countries that are less reliant on fossil fuels are not seeing the same prices that we're seeing in terms of electricity, etc., because they are genuinely somewhat self-sufficient. So, you know, this is a move I think we all agree, if we could do so in a fair way, we'd be far better off, wouldn't we, if we could generate our own electricity rather than relying on piping it in from elsewhere. It has to be done right, though, because, you know, I've heard on the show a few times, heat pumps are fantastic if you've got a very well-insulated home, but are not very efficient if you don't. So people have to be advised and financed to do it the right way. When we talk about the cost of living, we often talk about food or heat. You know, isn't that the phraseology that's often used, especially during the winter? But lots of people, it seems, are struggling actually just to take medicines to make themselves feel better. And I'm reading in the Irish Independent that more than one in three people say the price of over-the-counter medicines has stopped them from buying a treatment they needed. Financial worries have left some people cutting back on common medicines such as painkillers, hay fever and gastrointestinal treatments, new research reveals today. Nearly 8 in 10 said they would find it helpful if they were always informed by their pharmacy of a better value alternative. A generic medicine treats the same disease or condition as the original version and can be 20% to 25% cheaper, with the gap in costs of some treatments even higher. So, I mean, I don't want to pry into anyone's private life, but I would be interested because it helps form conversations and questions going forward. Do you find yourself, you know, having to be careful with what medicines you're buying because the cost of them? Now, I'm not saying there's any conspiracy or anything untoward and any act of violence is to be strongly condemned. But every time Donald Trump is in a bit of a sticky wicket, there's an attempt on his life, it almost seems. There's been three now, and each time, not least the most recent, it's been really when he's under extreme pressure, particularly from his own party and own supporters. And as I say, I'm not suggesting for a second, am I, that there's anything untoward going on here, but it is really quite remarkable. Many of us have been alive and would remember the occasional attempt on a president's life, but this is the third one. There was the shooting in his ear, which was remarkable how well his ear healed. God, I do sound like I think it's a conspiracy. I don't. Then there was the guy who we've never heard of again that snuck onto his golf course. And now this latest attempt, it would seem, on his life, Cole Thomas Allen. Well, experts believe the security breach where a gunman charged past Secret Service agents to get to the room where US President Donald Trump could have been a catastrophe. But despite the presence of Trump and senior politicians and officials among the 2,500 people at the prestigious annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, Cole Thomas Allen evaded detectives by simply checking in as a guest at the Washington Hilton. And because obviously you can freely carry weapons, he was able to take weapons up to his room. He was armed with a handgun, shotgun and knives and was able to walk about freely before the attack on Saturday night. But what was he expecting to do with those weapons in such a heavily fortified event? But anyway, there you go. And on to sport finally. Listen, we could still go on and win the blooming thing, and it could be a blessing in disguise, who's to say. But everyone had Down written off, didn't they? 3-21 to 1-21. They beat Donegal yesterday. Conor Laverty fired up his Down troops by showing them a TV graphic ahead of their win over Donegal. The Mourn Chiefs screensaver on his phone for the last 3 weeks was a graphic of the Ulster Senior Final Champion, the Ulster Senior Football Championship draw shown on TV, with the semi-finals reading Donegal versus Armagh Tyrone, and he used it to show his panel just how much they had been written off as they were facing the back-to-back Ulster SFC winners in Letterkenny. And it would seem Conor had a plan himself and had been building up to this event. And some interesting comments from him after the game yesterday, where he said, like, you know, during the week he thought he was ahead of his team in terms of confidence, and then asked them again at halftime and they had the belief. As I say, you know, there's still an entire championship to go through, effectively, an All-Ireland series, and Donegal could very well still go on to win it. But interesting. Maybe it is the checkup we needed. I don't know. What do you think? Any views on that game, and really to not just about us, but about the opponents? We'll have Brendan Devaney to preview his podcast a little later on, but we can put those talking points to him. I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say. I'm joined on the programme now by Remelton GP, Dr. Kieran O'Farrey. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Morning, Greg. How are you doing?
It's good to have you on the programme. Right, you spoke recently at a meeting, a gathering of doctors, the annual meeting of the Irish College of GPs in Dublin over the weekend, and I suppose laid bare the realities of life as a rural GP. And before we get into that, Do you think that it's difficult for GPs to speak out, if you know what I mean, the same way as it might be difficult for other groups of workers? So, oh, you're feeling sorry for yourself, GPs, this, GPs, that, the other. Do GPs feel a bit muted, do you think, in telling their truth?
I suppose I was asked to, I was part of a group discussing some of the challenges of rural general practice. And yeah, you can see the headline focuses on a negative, whereas a lot of what I spoke about was the positives of rural general practice as well. So often, yeah, you're afraid when you speak that the focus is often on the negative and not on the positive.
Well, let me focus on the negative, if you don't mind, and we'll also talk about the positive, because you related a story of pressure. I've spoken to GPs in the past who were long past retirement, Kieran, but they felt that they couldn't. Now, you're a long way from retirement, don't get me wrong, but they felt a pressure, a loyalty to their patients, you know, when they were concerned there's no one coming through to step into my shoes, etc. Is that the type of pressure you felt in getting back to work when you went through a recent operation?
Yeah, I suppose, like, I love my job, and I'm relatively new in my practice in Remelton, 2 years there. So, you know, I was keen to get back to make sure that patients were getting looked after and the continuity of care continued.
But this talks, does it, to a gap in enough GPs in rural Ireland in particular? Because, you know, you should be able to take the 6, 7, 8 weeks that you advise one of your patients to take, right? You had a knee surgery. But, you know, there's obviously a gap in terms of cover.
Yeah, so this came from a recent Irish College of GPs report into workforce pressures across the country, where rural Ireland was highlighted as one of the areas where there are workforce pressures. And one of the things there is that we do have, you know, more single-handed GPs spread out over a larger area, more older GPs who are closer to retirement. And what we're trying to do is ensure that these smaller practices remain viable, that younger GPs want to come and work there and can settle in their local communities, so that everybody, no matter where they live in the country, has access to a local GP.
Why is there a shortage, do you believe? Are they being attracted to the urban areas? Are they travelling abroad? Why are we seeing this shortage?
Yeah, it's multifactorial. As you said, one of the issues is that younger GPs are more attracted to urban areas, maybe larger practices where they've got more supports, more people around them. Obviously, if you're in smaller practices on your own, some of the challenges are to do with locum cover, out of hours cover, you know, making sure that you've enough of a team around to provide the service that you need. You know, our contract dates back to the 1970s, and it's a 24 hours a day, 365 days a year contract. So it's up to the GP running that practice to ensure that he or she always is somebody there to look after the practice, no matter what the circumstances.
Mm. But also, too, in terms of, it's not just cover, of course, it could be replacing GPs that might be retiring. Again, what could be done to entice, you know, newer qualified GPs into these positions?
Yeah, so I suppose nationally, the number of GPs in training has been increasing. From 2022, the number of new GPs coming in to training each year has gone from 258 to 350 this year. And in Donegal, that number has increased from 6 new trainees each year to 15. So that is definitely going to help ensure that we have GPs hopefully staying in the area. The International Medical Graduate Rural GP Programme has also helped bring approximately 120 GPs from abroad into rural Ireland. And I'm sure many people will have seen that many of our newer GPs in Donegal come from overseas, and they're a very welcome addition to the GP workforce here in Donegal. So we have to continue to ensure that those who are training in Donegal want to stay here and can find jobs, can work here.
I do often wonder what gaps are we leaving elsewhere when we draw medical professionals from other parts of the world, but maybe there is an oversupply in some parts of the world.
Yeah, obviously that's a challenge everywhere, and you know, we have to, our job is to try and ensure that we look after our patients and our community. And the ESRI report has projected that we need approximately 6,500 GPs in the coming year, and we're currently somewhere between 4,500 and 4,900. So we need to increase our GP workforce to make sure that GP practices around the country continue to have a supply of GPs to work in them.
This is probably an anecdotal opinion. I don't expect you to have the figures, but we've seen a dramatic increase in the population in Donegal over the last number of years. Have we seen any increase in the number of GPs servicing that population?
I don't have the specific numbers for Donegal, but I know nationally there's been an increase of approximately 9% in the GP workforce, but we've seen a population increase of about 10%. So we're really only standing still with that. We haven't increased our GP population to the extent that we need. And as I said, projections are there that we need a significant increase in the GP workforce over the coming years to keep up with that increasing population, as well as an increasing aging population with more complex needs. And general practice has become increasingly complex over the last number of years. We're providing far more chronic disease management now. Much of that care has been taken away from the hospital. We saw at the conference at the weekend that there's been a massive increase in consultations regarding menopause, increase in obesity care. And a lot of that is being provided in general practice, and we're best suited to do that if we have the right supports as well.
That a lot of the conditions you've just mentioned too seem like they might be quite, you know, not a fast turnaround, you know, in terms of how long a patient might be in the room with you. Is that a factor? You know, it's not like I go in with a stiff elbow or something and you sign something and I'm out, right? The stuff that you're talking about there, you know, especially if it's care that might have been done in a hospital before, that requires time. If a woman's coming in to talk to you about menopause or what have you, you know, that requires your time. And of course, that's potentially another stop for someone else.
Absolutely. And that is the challenge. You know, if we're providing increased complex care, to have enough GPs to be able to give people that time that they need to get the right advice and the right treatment.
How big of a factor is our setup, for an example, where we have one acute hospital covering this massive space? And, you know, we know we're working hard to try and get increased investment, increased capacity or what have you. But how big is the impact of having a hospital that, you know, particularly many, I think older people and younger people too, will almost do anything not to attend? They shouldn't, but do anything not to attend for fear of a long wait in ED. Does that put extra pressure on GPs in this county compared to a county whereby the hospital is better fit for purpose?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, you know as much as anybody the challenges that Letterkenny University Hospital has, and that does have a knock-on effect in general practice. You know, GPs across the country see approximately 21 million consultations a year, and only a very small proportion of those are referred to the emergency department. But our health system is often far too focused on the emergency department and on tertiary care. And what we want to see is the shift in resources away from hospital care towards community care, where care can be provided as close to people at home as possible, and where resources are made available, such as the chronic disease management program in general practice. We've seen the huge benefits of that with reduced admissions to the emergency department for patients who are part of that program, with things like COPD, heart failure. You know, the majority of type 2 diabetes care now is provided in general practice, which is a massive shift in the last 10 years. And that's great for patients, where they can get their appointments close to home with good quality care, hopefully keeping them away from the emergency department and leaving that free for those in need.
We see a GP shortage, as we've been referencing throughout this conversation, mostly in rural and deprived areas. and I'm comparing apples and oranges here, but we recognise that in education, potentially with the likes of DESH schools, etc. Do you think we should be looking at a system, if one isn't already there, and I don't believe it is, whereby, you know, we try and tip the scale a little bit more in rural and deprived areas, maybe offer different incentives or what have you, to try, rather than just saying, hey, it's beautiful here, come here, but right, try and incentivise people, GPs, to come to a particular area?
Yes, I think we do need that. There is a rural practice allowance, which is historic, and I think needs reform. Many,
it's good there's something there then that could be built on, though, so that's a step in the right direction.
Absolutely, but you know, I'm a rural practice and I don't qualify for it, so you know, it's too restrictive, and it would be great to see that expanded to allow rural practice to thrive and support the communities where we work.
A caller says, Greg, the new medical school in McGee in Derry will ensure we have a good supply of doctors into the future. We're already seeing the benefits of it. I don't think we can take anything for granted, and we can't presume that people will stay and work where they're educated either. Have you a view on that?
Yeah, I think it is great to see people being trained locally. It's fantastic. I know some people going through that programme, and I suppose now coming up to people doing their Leaving Cert, I'd like to encourage people to think of medicine as a career. It's an incredibly rewarding career. I love my job. I heard you talking this morning about not getting that Sunday morning dread, and I'm in the exact same boat. I love going to work every day. I get to meet fantastic people, and it's very, very rewarding. So I'd encourage anybody out there who's thinking about it to go ahead and take the leap.
Yes, and obviously, you know, at times when we speak to you and other medical professionals as well in Donegal, it's often in the context of an understrained or stretched health system. A health system that works, you know, generally quite well, but we always have to try and make sure that we have a health system on par with other parts of the country and indeed the world. Talk to me a bit more about those positives as work as a GP. Kieran, is it the interaction? Is it the people? Because you form a trust, you know, your local GP is a pillar. And I think to some extent we had that with the guards, but because the way the guards were restructured, it's hard to have that sort of personal relationship. But I believe they used to be one pillar, and to some extent they can be. But certainly a pillar that remains in the community is that trusted GP. And it must be a wonderful position to be in.
Yes, fantastic. As I said, I love my job, and you know, every day is filled with patient interaction, where you're getting to see a huge variety of people, and you know, you're getting to see the happy moments and the sad moments in life, new babies, and hopefully being there for people in their time of need, which is obviously rewarding. And you know, it's an exciting job. It's great to think that you can make a difference. And you know, we've a great GP community here in Donegal. We've got a local clinical society where we meet regularly. We've got small group teaching where GPs meet in six areas around the country every month to learn from each other and share knowledge. And you know, we're supported by some fantastic colleagues in Letterkenny University Hospital who are obviously always under strain, but you know, we've a great relationship with our hospital colleagues as well, who are there to support us. And I suppose we're all hopefully trying to encourage better healthcare here in the county. And you know, lots of the campaigns that you've been involved in, it's all about trying to ensure that patients can have access to things, because obviously the challenges of traveling to Galway for specialty care is unique to us here in Donegal. And we all want to advocate for better services here locally, so that our patients can get care close to home. And you know, I've worked in Letterkenny University Hospital myself, and it's great to be able to provide as much as we can for people here in Donegal.
Yeah, I've been in and out of there quite a bit recently, and you know, the staff are always cool, calm and collected, and with a smile on their face, even in the most challenging of working conditions. And the majority of people go in there, get turned around and get home in a better position too. We should never forget that. And finally, Kieran, too, you know, there's obvious stuff I'd imagine that you, and we can't even touch this because we don't want to go into anyone's personal lives or anything, but, you know, when that door closes behind a patient too, it's not always necessarily about a physical ailment or what have you. Sometimes maybe there can be a confessional element to it as well, where they can confide in you. And I would say there's a lot of positive impacts you've had in people in some other less obvious areas, you know, when they've been able to come in with you and have a chat with you as well, which I can imagine is challenging for you, but also incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, the confidentiality of a GP consultation is, you know, one of it's fantastic, and it allows people to come and talk to us about any problems they have. We're not there to judge. We're there to listen and to help. And again, hopefully we're there for people to do that. And that is very, very rewarding.
Thank you for your time. Good to see. How is the knee?
It's getting there. Yeah.
Do you play golf or anything, or run or football or what?
No, I hurt it in an accident. So I had a cruciate ligament repair. So it's
a biggie. It's a big one. There, yeah. All right, good stuff. Thanks so very much. Well, hopefully you've got the best of care anyway. Yourself.
Oh, fantastic, yeah.
Okay, look after yourself. That's Dr. Kieran O'Farrey there. Sorry, but a loose cable and it's making beepity beep noises. Okay, Dr. Kieran O'Farrey there, GP in Remelton. The highs and lows of being a GP in rural Ireland. I think doctors worked far harder years ago compared to the young doctors. Now, nobody wants to do anything, and all patients are sent to the ED. Many doctors worked up to 11 o'clock at night. I do remember back in the day, GPs were different. I remember they would call to the house, and maybe they still do to some extent, and what have you, right? But lots of you listening will have an experience where someone or you were sent to the ED where, you know, you felt you didn't need to be there. But I've spoken to people that work in the ED, and the pressures on the hospital are about people that have been admitted or need to be admitted to the hospital. That's what's causing the delays. It's not people just going through the ED and getting seen. It's people who are that sick that need to be admitted to the hospital. That's where an awful lot of the choke, the bottleneck is. So that sort of counteracts the point that there's lots of people in there that don't need to be there. See this minor injuries clinic thing, if they ever get that up and running, that will be really significant in terms of taking lots of people. The three or four times I've done 9, 10, 11 hours in the ED in Letterkenny University Hospital was stuff that a minor injuries clinic would sort out. You see lots of people in there with a twisted knee, sore ankle, etc. So I think it wouldn't be too hard to get to where we need to be with the right facilities like that minor injuries clinic. And also, I think there are definitely people that are sent to the ED that potentially could get their care elsewhere. But that's not the problem. The problem with the hospital is people that are that sick. So when you hear the trolley numbers where you've got 41 people waiting for admission to Letterkenny University Hospital, they're not people sent by the GP to the ED that don't need to be there. And in fairness, the hospital's honest about this. The people that don't need to be there are seen last because they are triaged on a medical need. So that's why you're often sitting there for a long time with a potentially broken ankle or something along those lines. Right, anyway, sorry to pontificate, but I haven't had a chance to waffle for a week. We're in the company now of the presenter of Highland Radio's GEA podcast, the DL Debate. Brendan, good morning to you. How are you, my friend?
Yes. Good, Greg. Yourself, buddy?
I'm good. Right. I said at the start of the show, was it a case that, because, you know, we can talk about what we did wrong or what we did right, but we came up against a team. Is it going too far to say we were playing checkers and they were playing chess?
Well, Greg, yeah, it's a head-scratcher. I just think, Greg, particularly in the new rules in the modern game now, it's all about energy and high intensity. And if you haven't got that, which we hadn't yesterday in terms of what we should have been, then you're automatically going to be up against it. And down came and they brought all that, brought all the pace. So we were always chasing it a bit, even though we probably missed a lot of opportunities, particularly first half. We just didn't look right. Some of our players didn't look on it the way we expected, and down capitalised.
Maybe the last time we saw that was in last year's All-Ireland final. What happens as a former player yourself where you can, you know, seemingly be untouchable and then, as a whole, on the day, seem flat? What's happening there? Because we know, you know, Jim McGuinness, we know his ability. We know his tactics and how he can man-manage, etc. So what could happen on a day where a team can appear flat? And as I say, the last time I recall that being was that final against Kerry. No explanation, just a flat team. Well, we put it down to miles on the clock, potentially. But what happened yesterday then?
Well, I suppose we came into the season, we won the McKenna Cup, we came into the league and we were moving well. It looked like we could beat any teams that we needed to. We maybe dropped off a small bit then on the final couple of games there, particularly against Roscommon and Monaghan, where we were kind of, did we want to be in a league final? Yeah. And then we played Kerry and we obviously shot the lights out with Kerry. So what led into this, I suppose, in Kerry, because Kerry were maybe a bit like we were yesterday, they weren't on it. It was so easy for us. And we had away in a training camp then, and, you know, all the talk was about all Ireland's and what Donegal were going to do. And it's very hard as a human being to get away from that, Greg, and to get your head out of it. Meanwhile, Down struggled to get over Wexford, who had a bad beating then in Leinster, and they obviously were playing in Division 3. So everything was putting Donegal on this massive pedestal. Now, that said, you know, you look at Jim's record in Ulster, I mean, 7 years, up until this point, one defeat. I mean, it just didn't seem like, even if we were off it a small bit, that we would have too much experience and too much know-how and we would get the job done. But listen, again, I got to say, well done to Down. I mean, they were first class. I think at half-time for me, like what I would have done with Donegal was went back into how we were actually playing last year, went into what we call a low block defensively because our defence was wide open. I would say Down couldn't believe how easy they were getting shots away in that. So at half-time, I would have come back in because if Down won the ball, turned over the ball, won a kick out, when they attacked, it was 1-1 and it was a simple hand pass and it was usually an unchallenged shot. Whereas when Donegal went down the other end of the pitch, they always had their block of defence set. And when we went down to their scoring zone, there was two or three tackling at us. And that's normally what you expect from Donegal. So I was a bit surprised we didn't go a wee bit more defensive, sit in the second half and kind of, you know, play our way into the game because you could see there were signs in the first half that we were off it. But
maybe Jim again saw enough in the first half to think that, because in the league campaign there have been, you know, shaky first halves, and then we've blown the opposition away in the second half. Maybe I don't think not that we are underestimate that Down did have a plan, and it seems they executed that plan, and maybe just on the day. You know, maybe we don't have the solution to it all and need to even adapt even further on the day because, you know, they came in there, the management came in there believing that they had got their players to a point, 10 weeks effectively together, got the team to a point whereby they knew they could unlock Donegal. There was a genuine confidence there, particularly in the management and more latterly in the team.
And definitely, as you said, they came with a plan, they carried out. They came playing championship. I don't think you could say it was a championship performance from Donegal.
Right, interesting, which is
a different, and because there's such a short time frame now, it used to be this thing when we were playing, it could be 6 weeks to the championship. You had this massive block of training, you had this big extra surge energy. Now there isn't a lot of time to drop and lift it, but certainly Down did that. And that last year in the group stage of the championship, Greg, Down acquitted themselves really well against all the top teams. So when you drill down into it, they had a decent team. They weren't to be taken lightly, but because they were in Division 3, struggled in the league final against Wexford, the way Donegal played, everything was built into this big case of it was Donegal's to win. But now, Greg, if you look at it in terms of, right, what's the positives from this? People are looking at, right, you want, say, come into the season flying, won the league, won the McKenna Cup. If you go through Ulster then you're into the All-Ireland Series, then you're in the quarter semi-final, right? So a lot of big, big games for players to constantly get up for. Now, we have this huge break. So we'd won back-to-back Ulsters. The big thing for Donegal this year, obviously, we want to win the All-Ireland. So in terms of your All-Ireland tilt, when the dust settles in this, Greg, and these lads get back to what they're doing best at, they will come much fresher in the All-Ireland series. And maybe that's when it comes to an ultimate big day, if we could get back there.
Yeah, for sure. But also, too, though, opposition now will say, well, maybe Donegal aren't the gods in the game that we thought they were going to be this year. You know, that can work both ways. But you would...
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. And listen, I think that would be music to the ears of Jim McGuinness because, you know, if you go out on the pitch thinking, as you said there, that you're going to win this match without doing the necessary things first. You know, you always say, you know, you've got to earn the right to win a football match. And we didn't do that yesterday. Down did it. And there's the learning in that, Greg. But as I say, in many ways, maybe in terms of the total season, it could be something now that could
the Early kick up the bomb rather than getting it in the last game of the season. And also, too, I think it's really important that we keep our Donegal heads screwed on and don't sort of lose the run of ourselves. We don't have to go back very, very long where we were completely in the doldrums. And that game yesterday, that defeat yesterday, wouldn't have been a surprise. We've had a very quick turnaround from being at a very low ebb to a point whereby we can have this conversation right now. It would have been a different conversation a couple of years ago, right?
Exactly, Greg. And I suppose that same context is what, you know, I was talking about at the after the final last year and just the phenomenal couple of years it was. I think, yeah, people look very close at the here and now and where we're at and what we need to be and where we need to be as a football team. But as you said, there's a group of players coming down from down with a completely different mindset that they're coming to take you out. And they did that yesterday. But listen, I guess I say that wasn't a Donegal performance here that we're used to. Or
if they beat the best Donegal, that we'd be in real bother.
Exactly. Yeah. If this came down to a nip and tuck game where we played well, I would be like, well, but you can see, you know, right across the board from our boys, of course, the usual suspects tried to drag us in and drag us through the game and no more than Michael Murphy in the middle of that. But down just the too many guys out there, and particularly big Murdoch. I mean, he was absolute colossus. You know, I know Daniel Guinness, I see he got man of the match here. It was Murdoch was for me, he was the man. Like, we just couldn't handle his physicality. And again, like, there's learnings in there. For us in terms of how we perform going forward.
Yeah, the ladies were in action against Armagh as well.
Yeah, listen, it was a great week for us. The ladies lost to Armagh and also championship.
We've had a real wake-up call this.
The hurlers lost to the Christy Ring. Yeah, listen, sometimes we have won on weekends, but no, it wasn't to be this weekend for Donegal Sport. But as you said, Greg, you've got to take the good with the bad.
Yeah, well, there's going to be a full review of the Christy Ring clash with Derry for our hurlers, the disappointment for the Donegal ladies in the Ulster Championship against Armagh, and much more, of course, on that big game at O'Donnell Park. The guests on the show include 2012 hero Frank McGlynn, multiple Ulster Championship winner Niall O'Donnell, and Neil Loughlin of the Irish News. So it's going to be a wedged DL debate just after the 7 o'clock news this evening, no doubt.
Yeah, and Neil Loughran just happens to be a down man as well.
Of course, yeah. Is that a coincidence of booking or is that intelligent production?
That was intentional, Greg. Okay, all right. So even he couldn't build the case at all last week when we were talking. So he was he had a Cheshire Cat smile on his face yesterday.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, sometimes people play their chances down. There's a lot of mind games goes on across sport. All right, good stuff. Thanks, Brent.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. Look after yourself. Now I'll get to some of your comments on the football there. Lots of you texting in. Thank you so much. Get your phones out. I want to hear from you. I want you to be part of this program. It's your show. When a team is getting beat, says a listener, why does the management not change the players? They did the same against Kerry. It was a shocking poor game. Another, interesting to hear Brendan Devaney blame media for Michael Murphy's yellow card. Is he not the media? I suppose sometimes when you... I didn't hear all of those comments, but I think we always felt that, not the media, us as fans, that, you know, it wouldn't be too hard to get a booking if you were Michael Murphy, so to speak, especially with the controversy a little earlier on. But when you're the Donegal media, you're not really commenting as the Donegal media, I don't think. Not a great result, but the ground proved to be a very suitable place to hold games. Let's hope we see more of them there. But conversely, the first time that a quarterfinal was held in O'Donnell Park in 75 years and we lost, maybe we should stick to Ballyshannon and Ballybuffet. Both teams played on the same ground, but I presume you're talking about tradition or, you know, the rub of the green or whatever it might be. Chin up to the Donegal lads. You can't win them all. They take lessons from the Down game and they'll come back stronger. I think I agree with you there. Hi, Greg. Well done to Down yesterday from a Donegal supporter. Talking to many Down supporters before the game, good people. Hope they go on now and win it. From a Donegal point of view, we were well below par and the curse of O'Donnell Park continues. And hopefully there isn't a championship game there for a long time. The curse, that's the word I was looking for. I think Jim's plan is to forego Ulster and give the players more rest to concentrate on the All-Ireland. They played some players yesterday who were making their county debut, not the action of a manager who's too worried about losing, or the actions of a manager who's got great faith in his team, be it the old legs or the young blood. I cannot imagine any Donegal team ever under any manager setting up to lose an Ulster Championship game. But maybe you disagree. Let us know. Do you agree with that caller? The team was poor. This is on GEA. The team was poor. There was a lack of play in them. It felt like they didn't want to win and they were on the training ground as opposed to a match field. It's clear Jim McGuinness's focus is on next year's championship and not this year's. Okay, I don't get that, but okay. Hi, I'm a Down man who's lived in Donegal for over 30 years. That was a absolutely brilliant performance by the men in red and black. We'd been completely written off before a ball was kicked. Some Donegal supporters who I know had lost the run of themselves and were planning their day out in Clonus to play Armagh. Down are a proud football county. We've come through tough times of late, but that win yesterday shows we're back as a football power. And I hope you go on and win the whole blooming thing in Ulster. Did the Down team stay in Letterkenny on Saturday night? I don't know. Take David Clifford out of Kerry and it's a different team. Michael Langan, our all-star, was a big miss. And last one, just before the 10 o'clock news, I hope it's another 50 years before there's another game in Letterkenny. We should never play there. They don't like it. I won't use the phraseology they did, but they don't like it too much. What do you think? How much of a difference does the ground play in it? And when is Ballybuffet going to be back up and running again? I presume it's in the not-too-distant future. We are joined on the programme now by Debbie Mullen, chairperson of the Road Victim Support Northern Ireland Donegal. Debbie, thanks for joining us this Monday morning. I hope you are well.
Yes, Greg, thank you for inviting me on to this morning. Thank you.
I'm reflecting on a terrible weekend on the roads. Five people have lost their lives on the roads. The first person who sadly was killed in a crash over the weekend was a teenage boy, Josh Morrow, from County Donegal. The sporting clubs he was associated with, the school he was associated with, and first and foremost, his family. I can't even pick words to try and express how sorry I am for their loss. And I think it's really critical, Debbie, when we speak to you, that we're recognising that it's not five as a number. These are five devastated families. It's terrible, terrible situation.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's not just five families. It's those five individuals, families, their friends, their wider community that will be hugely impacted by one individual loss, never mind five losses right across the whole island of Ireland. You know, it's a very difficult place for these people at this moment in time because there will be lots of feelings of shock, numb, even has it actually happened, you know, and it's very hard for people to come forward to support whenever they don't know what's the right thing to say or do. But presence is most important. To be present with somebody is the thing that I find is most important in the aftermath of such devastation and life-changing events like this.
Yes, and in our own local tragedy here, I mean, obviously the community, family and friends will rally around the family. But, you know, in terms of Josh's school colleagues landing into school today, you know, it's a lot for young people to take, and for many of them it might be their first sense of loss, such as the way life is laid out, but also for his teammates and stuff. You know, when you get someone who's such an integral part of a tight organisation, and it's great to see the recognition of that now, isn't it, whereby we hope we'd never have to do it, but schools and sporting organisations understand that the support there for peers needed as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's fantastic. We at Road Victim Support Northern Ireland Donegal have been invited in to offer that additional support to the communities and to sports clubs in the aftermath of that loss, because it's just trying to get the communication going. You know, it's so important to talk about, you know, the person who has lost their life and keep their memory alive. But also when something so sudden and so traumatic, it has such an impact to individuals. And maybe that person who's not talking, who's not sharing how they're feeling. So I imagine today the school will most definitely have put something into place there to support those pupils, but it'll be important to put further support going forward over the next few weeks and months as well.
How do you what is your best advice for in the home? You know, because maybe, you know, group events or won't reach everybody. And we're talking about, generally speaking, maybe this is information that might be useful for us broadly going forward, though we wish we didn't need it. If mum and dad are confused as to how to discuss this with a teenager, for an example, is there some guidance that you can give?
Well, you know, in the very early aftermath, mum and dad will be trying to come to terms with this loss themselves. And sometimes in that, you know, in the grieving process, we do, unfortunately, as a parent, I'll hold my hands up, we do forget that our other children are grieving too, because we're so caught up in our own grief. And it's really important to be aware that we all need to talk. We all need to share what's going on, what our feelings are, what our emotions are, and how can we help each other. Everybody grieves differently, and sometimes people don't want to mention what has happened, doesn't want to mention their loved one's name, doesn't want to see photographs or images. But what we would say is, within the home, that's actually really important to come to a place of acceptance. And, you know, while we know that they have lost their life, that doesn't mean it's easy to accept that. So communication is actually one of the key elements in trying to cope with grief.
I'm not talking to any of the circumstances surrounding any of the instances over the weekend, but we work closely with An Garda Síochána here in terms of appeals, slow down days, you know, particularly bank holiday weekends, public holiday weekends. And the reason we do that is statistically, these are the days or the periods of time where we see more tragedy on our roads. What we're also seeing, though, is, as it relates to stats, speeding, drink and drug driving, non-wearing of seatbelts, distracted driving, that message is not getting through. And I know there's a frustration amongst the traffic corps in that, you know, what else can we do? I wonder how we can connect this awful tragedy of this weekend in people's minds with the reality of our behaviour on the roads. Because such is the random nature of this, you know, you never know when you might be caught up in this, whether it's your fault or not, right? So I wonder what we can do in terms of messaging or education or whatever it might be, Debbie, to try and say the reason we do all of this, it's not to be preachy, it's because of terrible weekends like we've just witnessed.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you're aware, but Road Victim Support Northern Ireland Donegal has been very active in Donegal in recent months, and that we've been delivering what it's called a Drive to Arrive programme. And we've been putting that out through quite a few schools. We've been to Letterkenny University, been working quite closely with the Garda Síochána and actually Donegal County Council in delivering those road safety messages. What we do know, that behind every statistic is a family. But also statistically, what has caused the deaths on our roads? And it is one or more of the fatal five. So just what you spoke about there earlier, that is exactly what is causing the deaths on our road. So we believe that we do have to keep pushing forward with education, because it is people's behaviour that needs to change. And unfortunately, we can all become complacent on the road, every single one of us. And I hold my hands up to that most definitely in the past. But if we can save one life, and the difference about the workshop that we deliver is we are delivering it all from a lived experience. Every one of our volunteers come in to those schools and community organisations, and they deliver what it's like to get that knock on the door. The true devastation of losing somebody. And the aftermath. And our volunteers do this because they hope that only one person within that audience of that room that day will at least think before they are a passenger or a driver of a vehicle on the road.
Now, the fantastic work that you do is really quite targeted. In other words, you can't reach everyone, even though you might intend to do so. Is it time that some of this conversation, even using the skill sets of your group, that you know, it forms part of the 10, the 12 lessons or something. I don't know. Maybe one of or two of those lessons could be actually that hour you go into a space in your local town or village. And we don't try and scare the living daylights out of people, but give them the real information that you're delivering. You know, so that actually forms part of it. And, you know, maybe out of the 12 lessons, one or two could be the realities, because then you get everybody, right? And everybody has that information, that knowledge as they get onto the road. I'm not sure how it works, but we have to try something outside the box, I think, Debbie.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do believe that this, you know, the Drive to Brave programme, why we've targeted specifically for anybody 16 plus, a lot of the TYs within Donegal are bringing us on board to put us into their educational programme, because it's an interactive programme. So it's not about us sitting dictating to people. It's about our young people using our alcohol and drug goggles and trying to do things with that. We have a fantastic 15 VR headsets where they have to sit for 6 minutes in a 360 reenactment of an RTC. And then when we talk about the Fatal Five and the Ackerman Coast, which is for advanced driving, then our young people are able to see how those serious deaths and collisions could be further preventable. So I most definitely believe that schools are looking at this, and they are already putting this into their educational programmes, because we've been inundated this last 3 weeks now since we did a fantastic event, and we got great feedback from those last 3 weeks. We've been getting a lot of schools within Northern Ireland and Donegal who are asking us to come in and deliver that programme.
You know, and I think what's really interesting about that immersive experience that you're giving people, and I don't know the science of it, I'm not a psychologist, but you can't help but feel there's a bit of coding going on in the brain on a subconscious level where you're exposed to that. Like, do you ever have that situation whereby someone asks you the name of something and for all the world you don't know it, but 30 minutes later that name pops in, it's in there somewhere? And again, I'm clearly not a psychologist, but that immersive experience, you would hope it codes something in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, whenever you can leave something and people have a lasting impression, that is what people take away. And when they can be involved rather than dictated to and spoken to, we would rather have people be involved in and spoken with. And that is where we're seeing more and more people taking on what the message that we're delivering. And as much as I'm saying young people, this isn't specifically, because we have to be mindful. We just believe that if we start at the grassroots level up, that we are looking at the future drivers, and if we can educate them, then surely they will be the ones who will be much more aware of the dangers on our road.
Yes, and you've made it very, very clear, but you can, the point really is if someone's in their 40s and they smoke, for an example, you could move heaven and earth and they may never not smoking. But if you get to a 15, 14, 16-year-old and you say, this is why you shouldn't smoke, they never start smoking. And that's, it doesn't mean smoking isn't bad for the 40-year-old, but you have a chance maybe to get in early. And I think that's really what we're talking about here. Finally, Debbie, for the wider community, particularly maybe teenagers who have lost a friend or somebody in the school, and maybe mom or dad or mom and dad are in the house, and they don't really know how to have the conversation as to how this loss or this perhaps reality of mortality might be affecting their own child, separate from the family or the victim themselves. What is a sensible way of broaching the subject and making sure there's a space for the young person to speak or express, or to maybe if you need to explain something to them?
I think if there is parents out there and they are struggling with their teenager and to talk about this loss, it's really important that they reach out and get support. You know, Road Victim Support Northern Ireland Donegal offer that free support. We have a fantastic counsellor, Marie Fury, who delivers counselling in the County Donegal area. We have support meetings monthly in Letterkenny. But you can go onto our website and you can self-refer whatever it is that person, that young person, maybe it's a school, maybe it's an organisation, what it is you're looking for. Because emotional support in the aftermath of such a traumatic loss is vital, you know, to put out there for everybody impacted and affected. So I would say go on there and look for some support. It is there. It just means somebody has to go in there and access it.
Yeah, and we have to make sure we don't see any daisy chaining or anything like that in relation to...
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
And I'm putting it like that purposely, sensitively, but people will understand what I mean. Debbie, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it. Sorry, before I let you go, I think you referenced it. I just wanted to recap the best way for people to get in contact with the Road Victim Support Northern Ireland Donegal Group.
Yes, as I said, we have a self-referral portal on our website, or you can contact us on any of the medias. We are on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, and there's always somebody there to pick up those messages. But probably the best way is through the portal if somebody's looking for services or assistance within the community.
Debbie, thank you so very much for your time. It is the Greg Hughes Show here on Highland Radio, and we've got lots to pack in between now and 11 o'clock. And just to remind you, we do have a sister podcast to this programme. It is quite imaginatively called the Greg Hughes Podcast, and it's available on our website, highlandradio.com, or on Spotify and iTunes. And I think we're up to episode 13, 14 or 15. There's a lot of content there, a lot of interesting guests, from science to medical to all manner of things. Plenty in there, I think, for you to, maybe potentially enjoy. Some of the content is, it's more educational than potentially enjoyable, if that makes sense. But anyway, it's all there for you. And give us a like and subscribe too, if you don't mind, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, because that helps in spreading the word. Now, a landmark report published by the European Transport Safety Council reveals that cyclists' deaths across the European Union have barely declined over the past decade, even as deaths among car occupants have fallen at four times the rate. That's right across the European Union. Kieran Cannon is Cycling Ireland president. He joins me now. Good morning to you, Kieran. Does anything about this information, obviously it's very shocking and worrying, but does anything about it surprise you?
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners. It doesn't surprise me. It reflects the experience that we have here in Ireland, as well as that report that's just recently been published by the European Commission. We also did a survey of our membership here, and bearing in mind that Cycling Ireland is an all-Ireland organisation, we received over 2,000 responses to that. And it proves conclusively that cycling on Ireland roads is becoming more dangerous, not less dangerous. For example, over half of the respondents told us that 53% of them experienced close passing regularly. So close passing is not rare, it's become routine. Many of them, 51%, had a collision or a serious near miss in the last 12 months. So what we're seeing is a result of cyclists, and all kinds of cyclists, you know, people who are just commuting to work or to school in the morning, or people who are out for a spin with their friends at the weekend, they're all feeling deeply unsafe. They're altering the routes, they're avoiding certain roads and streets completely. And they're reducing, in many instances, simply not cycling anymore, which is a really devastating outcome in terms of their well-being and in terms of public health in general. So when thousands of cyclists across Europe and indeed across Ireland are telling us the same story, it becomes much more than anecdotal. It's systemic. It's hardwired into our road system across Ireland, across European Union, that if you are on a bike, you are subjected to significant risk and danger that you shouldn't be subjected to. There's no reason why you should be.
Yes, and I'm not saying this in any way to counter what you're saying. It's a separate point, really. But I mean, I think the Netherlands would have the highest number of cyclists in the EU, and that's an important element to this question. But they would also have some of the best infrastructure. They're way, way ahead of us in terms of, you know, motor-propelled vehicles and cycling coexisting. But they do have the highest rate of deaths per million, 15 deaths per million people versus two in Ireland. Again, back to the fact they've got a much larger number of cyclists. But so the point of my question is though, to some extent, as is with driving a car, is there an inherent risk or inherent danger with cycling that really can't be avoided if the Netherlands are seeing such high instances of death?
Well, what the Netherlands are actually seeing is so if you compare the Netherlands to most other European countries, and you compare the amount of kilometres travelled on an annual basis by cyclists, they have one of the lowest cyclist death, because simply they have more people cycling, thousands of, and more cyclists using safe, segregated cycling infrastructure. So that actual statistic where you just do cyclist deaths per million is seriously inaccurate when it comes to determining what exactly is happening. But I mean, you know, the Netherlands, in terms of what it has right now, wasn't always the Netherlands. Back in the 1960s, 1970s, the Netherlands was the same as any other country, in that they didn't have this superb cycling network they have right now. But in the mid-70s, they began to see a huge number of road deaths, cyclist road deaths happening, particularly children. And they started a campaign. The parents said, "We have enough." The campaign was called Stop the Child Murder. And emanating from that then was government support for the development of an extraordinary network of cycling infrastructure. So, and you're beginning to see, you know, examples of that happening some of our larger cities here in Ireland. We're beginning to see some investment at long last in safe cycling and segregated cycling infrastructure. But we've a lot more to do.
Yeah, but even here in the Northwest, Letterkenny, you know, it's tokenism, really. It's a tiny little cycle lane that has all the drainage running through it and stuff. So you're referencing the likes of Dublin, and I understand that. Kieran, I think part of our problem here is we're still entrenched in some motorists thinking cyclists shouldn't be on the road at all, and cyclists saying we have a right to be on the road and motorists shouldn't be driving too close to it. I think we need to accept that we have to coexist and move beyond that, because I think we're entrenched in that argument and we never get past that.
Correct, Greg. And that is so, so true. And funnily enough, in our Cycling Ireland survey, we also asked the question, out of the 2,200 people that responded, how many of you are motorists? How many of you hold a driving license? And it transpired that 96% of them are also motorists. So in terms of their assessment of the road environment, it was a very accurate assessment from the two sides of the windscreen, from behind the steering wheel and also from behind the handlebars of a bike. And you're right, we have to move away from this, as you say, this entrenched position of cyclists versus motorists. We're all out there trying to get to where we need to get to in a safe and secure manner. And, you know, and many of my friends at times were even wary of using the phrase cyclists anymore, because, you know, it automatically raises people's hackles, and it automatically puts people into two different camps, when in actual fact, all a cyclist is
they're
is
in
just,
the same camp. Yeah.
They're just a person on a bike.
Yeah, right.
They're just, you know, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your son or your daughter trying to get somewhere and hopefully get there unscathed and in a safe manner.
And if everybody
that goes out on the road in the morning, irrespective of what kind of mode of transport they're using, would just think for a moment about the implications for them and their family, if, God forbid, if one of their loved ones was to be involved in any kind of traffic accident. Right now, we lose somebody on Irish roads. Somebody dies on Irish roads every 48 hours. Some poor guard that somewhere has to go and ring that doorbell and deliver that tragic, horrific news. And you know, slowing down a little bit, just slowing down, being considered and respectful of others' safety, and just thinking for a moment about the implications of, you know, taking that irresponsible overtake, maybe glancing down at your phone. You know, all of these things add to the tragedy.
Yeah.
And if we stopped inserting ourselves or embedding ourselves in these camps and just thought, as you say, of people sharing the road together, irrespective of what transport mode they use, just trying to get home to their family safely. And sadly, if you look at, you know, the most vulnerable of our road users, there are people who cycle and walk. They account for about 40% of the deaths on our roads every year. So the people who pose the least risk of all to other road users are themselves significant victims of road violence and road risk.
And you know, what I think would help is a little bit of legislation in terms of cyclists and walkers. I'm not saying that they necessarily need to be policed more, but I just think if the motorists, there's something built into the psyche there, sort of some sort of a more level playing field in terms of responsibility in the roads, it might help. But I also must add, I have to put my hands up here, in fairness to the local authority and government funding, there is an active travel plan in Letterkenny where there's a lot of accommodation for walkers and cyclists. And there's been an awful lot of resistance to it. And we've platformed that here as well, if the truth be told. But it would make it shares the space better between motorists, cyclists and walkers, which is exactly what you're calling for. But there's been a great deal of resistance, primarily, of course, by those who are just trying to get around a town. We'll get past it, but that's where we're at.
We will. And, you know, if you're looking at the most efficient way of moving people around the town the size of Letterkenny, which is about, 25,000 people, if you look at the outer reaches of suburban Letterkenny right into the Market Square, you're probably talking about maybe a 5 to 6 kilometre journey. That can be done on a bike in a few minutes. And that's been the experience of other countries where they've made that possible, made it possible to do that in a safe and secure manner.
Okay.
And as you say, you know, the government is investing roughly about €1 million every day in active travel infrastructure development across the country. And as you say, we're beginning to see some early examples of that in places like Letterkenny and other similarly sized towns and cities around the country. And the fact is that if you make that possible for people, they will make that switch because, you know, and there's a cohort of people for whom their car is an absolute necessity. They have to have it for, you know, maybe bringing children to childcare or maybe because of the work they're involved in themselves. But there are other people who would much prefer to leave their car at home.
True, they can do.
And they don't have that option. They simply don't have that option.
Interesting to have a chat
and, you know,
about the flip
side. Let's finish one
yes,
thing,
go ahead, Kieran.
There is no hierarchy of road users where one particular kind of road user has precedence over another. That doesn't exist. Everybody on the road, whether you're driving a huge articulated truck or whether you're simply walking your child to school in the morning, you have a right to be there on that road and you have a right to arrive safely.
You do, but if that's a reference to an earlier point I made, as someone just driving on the road, and I don't have any angst with I've grown patience, right? So if I have to sit behind a cyclist for 5 or 10 minutes, you know, I can live with that nowadays. But when I'm driving in at winter time and I see the kids that you can't get them to wear a coat, right? They don't have any high vis on. I would love to see some sort of a situation where there was a compulsion to wear high vis. You see it at dusk too, you know, where people are hard to see. If you thought I was sort of referencing a hierarchy, I wasn't, but I think we could have rules whereby the responsibility to be safe and to be seen and to be lit up was on a legislative par, if that makes sense. Probably not practical, but that's the point I was trying to make here, and just in case that's what you were referencing.
Yeah, well, if I could just respond to that, Greg. I mean, there's a whole, as you know, there's a whole science around health and safety in your workplace where you're working right now, and indeed in manufacturing environments and building sites, and a science that has arrived at a kind of an internationally recognized hierarchy of controls, of safety measures. So you start by eliminating the hazard, then you remove dangerous machinery, you put guardrails around it, and when all that's done, you ask people, particularly on building sites, for example, to wear high-vis clothing. But in road safety, what we do is we forget about eliminating the danger and we skip straight to the last line, wear a helmet, be visible, watch out. So, you know, our entire road safety kind of conversation seems to center around the vulnerable people, the walkers and the cyclists, taking extraordinary steps to stay alive in a hostile environment rather than, why is that environment so hostile in the first instance?
No, I know, that's black and white. There's an awful lot of grey as well. I'm on about people walking on what would ordinarily be a safe stretch of road at night and it piddling rain and them in black. I get exactly where you're coming from, but I'm trying to talk in the grey area rather than the black and white. And I just think maybe we could do them at tandem just to try and bring people along here. And I'm not trying to finger blame. I'm trying to say, well, how do we get out of that entrenchment, right? That's really what I'm
that's
getting true. At.
That's
anyway,
a very valid question.
A very positive conversation. I don't disagree with you at all, but just teasing the convo out, and great to have you on the programme.
Likewise, Greg. Thanks.
Look after yourself. Thank you very much indeed. That's Kieran Cannon, Cycling Ireland President. Now, I'm joined in studio by Carolyn Murray, Director and General Manager of the Shandon Hotel and Spa at Marble Hill, and the new, not President, Chair of the Donegal Irish Hotels Federation. Congratulations on your elevation, your appointment to the top of a very important federation, I think, for tourism in this country.
Thank you, Greg, and thanks for having me on.
And you would have a good working relationship with your predecessor as well, so yeah. It's a smooth transition, I'd imagine.
Very smooth. Aisling Arnold and Niall Coffey are the two representatives, so it's kind of the original team, but we've just kind of changed seats. So we've done really good work this last 2 years. We created all sorts of new connections with Donegal Tourism, Fáilte Ireland, and we also created an event in Dublin called Reveal Donegal's True Potential, where we showcased all that Donegal has to offer to over 60 key decision makers in Dublin.
Are we at a fork in the road or a crossroads in terms of tourism in this county and our direction or our clientele or our customers or what?
It's a pivotal time, obviously, with everything that's going on in the world. But I think the key for Donegal, I mean, it's beautiful and the summers we're always busy. But the key for us and the focus for the branch is to tackle the weaker periods in Donegal, the winter times. And we can do it, like we've done it in the Shandon. So it's really just engaging with the supports that we have and the resources to try and extend the season so that we can have our hotels and our tourism products open longer during the year.
Like, presumably, there's millions upon millions of people in the world, right? So the good cohort, they want to travel at all different times of the year. Maybe it suits them at different times of the year. I think even if you come here in the summer, you're probably not necessarily coming here for the weather, though the weather helps. So there's no real reason why we couldn't have all different types of tourism. Even if it is just a relaxing hotel stay, or if you want to go out and witness the scenery with the right gear on, there's no real reason why we shouldn't be talking about a full year rather than a tourism season and shoulders.
Exactly. And Donegal's magical in wintertime with the turf fires and wrapping up warm on the beach and looking out at a nice sea view when it's wintry outside, especially with properties like the Shandon and other hotels in the county where you have a spa, you have a leisure centre, there's great food, you know, there's no reason why. So it's just trying to kind of get that out of people's heads. It was always just accepted 10 years ago, Donegal is quieter in the winter, but it's absolutely beautiful in the wintertime.
And we know if people get here that that's what they will feel. Like, yeah. We know that, right? So it's a case of getting the bums on the seats and getting them into the Northwest. Is that one of the greatest challenges, and how might we overcome that?
The only example I can give is from my personal experience was creating a visitor attraction in the winter months, and that was the magical Winter Wonderland package. So that leaves us busy November and December, and then that allows these young families to come to Donegal in the winter and appreciate its beauty, and then they come back then in January, February. So there's lots that we can do to extend the season. It's just communication and marketing.
So in your example, if they come from, say, out of the region and the drive up to the hotel or away from it, or I would say this place is absolutely stunning in the summer or the spring.
That's it. So it's just like a snowball effect then for everything else and the local businesses around as well.
So how do we do that then en masse, right? Rather than having individual places that are doing it very well, the likes of yourselves, Harvey's, Sandhouse, you know, there's other, I don't want to leave anybody out, but so how do we do that collectively, do you think, so that it's the county that's putting this message out?
That's a great question, Greg. It's really just collaboration and communication between all the tourism products, which is what we've done now the last 2 years with the branch. We have them all around the table, we're all engaging, and we're really drawing as much resources as we can to promote the weaker season and work together.
I saw one of a comment you made, we need to build on our existing momentum. Do we have momentum at the moment?
And
what does that look like?
Definitely at the moment. All the hoteliers are around the table and they're actively working with Donegal Tourism and Fáilte Ireland, and that new event that we've done as well in Dublin, we hope to do another one and maybe do one in Belfast. we're actively being proactive now in the market, whereas before we just weren't. We weren't there, and we definitely are now. So my biggest drive is to just keep that momentum going and grow on it.
Yeah, because we have, you know, some of the best facilities. I would argue the best county in Ireland to visit. We've got amazing people in the industry, you know, be it yourself, the head of Letterkenny Chamber. Yeah. Oh, there's so many different organisations that are headed up by brilliant people. So really, you know, we should set the bar, we should set the tempo, we should set the agenda, and that's your mission.
Well, that's what I said in my speech as well. Donegal,
I did read it actually.
Trendsetters. So I'm hoping that there's new energy now in all the heads of tourism and this last 2 years, and you can definitely see great collaboration.
Yeah, and just to give an example, right, so if you look at one business, like your own business, for an example, you know, we have got a bit of weather here, we're feeling a bit summery, okay, and we're wondering what's the summer going to be like. You guys are saying, well, what are we doing at Christmas? Yeah. So what are we doing as a county to say, you know, we hope we have a fantastic summer, mm-hmm. But what's going to happen in after Halloween? Because I think we've done quite well, have we, in getting from Easter to Halloween?
We have.
We've improved greatly, yes. And that's in a short number of years, isn't it?
For sure, yes. It is. The season is strong up until around Halloween. But definitely, like as you said, I'm working on Christmas now. You hope that the summer looks after itself. But that's just the nature of the business that we're in. You know, you're always working ahead. You're never quiet. You're always being strategic about the future. And obviously, looking at the challenges we have ahead too, you have to be more strategic and more on the ball than ever.
People probably have their phones out at the moment saying, well, why would anyone come here? The cost of everything, right? Now, I think I sound like an apologist for the sector. I don't mean it to be like that. But often people might give an example of, well, I want to stay in the heart of Letterkenny on a Saturday night, and this is the price of a hotel. Whereas a Sunday night, a Friday night, a Tuesday night, a Wednesday night, you know, it's about demand, like anything else. So I think if we look at, generally speaking, we do offer better value. There are high input costs, right? What it costs you to put a plate of food out, there's a lot behind that, between, you know, from eggs to staff to tax to VAT to power to everything. You're not, I mean, the industry is not creaming the public on food.
Absolutely not. It's very, very tight margins at the moment. And obviously, from an IHF perspective, that's a representative body. You know, we can't talk about what people should charge. But I know that from engaging with the industry, everyone is trying to keep their costs down. Mm. They're trying to be competitive. They want the business. So I think everyone is doing their absolute best, and the margins are extremely tight.
Yeah, and the thing with a company like yours, though, of course, you can say, well, there's the spa, there's the bar, there's the rooms, there's the restaurant, and there's a little bit of, you know, whereas if you're a standalone restaurant, the challenges are even greater,
it's
I would imagine.
Extremely difficult. Yeah. I can't imagine how difficult it is for them.
Yeah. But anyway, that being said, there's still a market out there, and it's reaching them. A lot of the conversation we've had so far is about what we can do for ourselves, and I think that's so important, and I say that on this show all the time, whether it's about what we're talking about or health matters or infrastructural matters, when we organise ourselves, I think we're unbeatable. But is there more externally that needs to be done for us, getting people here? So in other words, when people get off at Ireland West, they turn right, not left. When people get off in Dublin, that they understand that Ireland isn't Temple Bar.
Yeah, I think that's what we're trying to do in the Donegal branch at the moment with the event that we just had. You know, as you say, when they fly into Dublin, it's as far to Kerry as it is to Donegal, but they all seem to go that road. So we're really trying to focus on that narrative now, and obviously the infrastructure has improved, the roads. So we're really trying to push that, because there's no reason why they shouldn't come up to Donegal. It's just getting them here in the first place.
So, I mean, obviously the question when someone gets appointed to a position is what's your priorities? I mean, it's continuing the work, isn't it? There's not necessarily anything specific, or is there?
Well, there's obviously continuing the momentum that Aisling has built up as chair, but obviously sustainability is a big key factor as well. And, you know, making sure that our voices are strong at National Council and with government to get more supports for hotels and to retrofit their properties.
A caller says, delighted to see Carolyn take up this role. Her positivity will make the county vibrant. They say vibrate, but I presume they mean vibrant. We don't want it vibrating too much, right? We've one of the most beautiful counties and we just don't realise it enough. I agree with that. Rural hotels do need, like Carolyn, to come up with ideas to attract groupings in October and November. I see towns like Westport attract crowds all year round. What can we do to get this group of people? But, like, I don't want to mention, but there are lots of places. Like, say, for instance, Donegal Town has in recent years sort of repositioned itself as an all-year-round destination. It could be the Abbey Hotel and Country Music or other, you know, they have become, Donegal Town was always a destination, but I think it's a perfect example of how you can really ramp that up. McCafferty's now have two massive mega pubs in there and the people are coming there. So there are other examples as well, exactly what you've been talking about and what you're doing. It depends on your location. So we're doing that. We just need to do more of that. And also outside of hotels, you know, exactly. other things that people can do.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're focusing on now as the Donegal branch. And Donegal Town has done fantastic, as you said, the country music events. And it really is just creating visitor attractions. And if you get them there in the wintertime once or twice, it kind of becomes a snowball.
Yeah, that's your all year round, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very good. Exciting times. What's the term, a year or two?
It's two, but we have someone in the pipeline, hopefully to take over another, and maybe if they're up to speed, maybe in the next year or two. It just depends how much I get done and how fresh
there's
I stay.
There's a fluidity there, isn't
that's
there,
it,
as well? Because
yeah,
you've an awful lot on your plate, like your predecessor had as well.
Exactly.
And she had a baby during her term, I think.
I don't know how Aisling done it. She frightened the life out of me, like, because I obviously was in the wings and seen the amount of work that goes into it. So I haven't come to it naive. I know the dedication that it's going to take.
Okay, well, listen, the very best of luck with it. I mean, obviously, you know, you're going to do fantastic. I think people recognise that. And it's, you know, there's some brilliant, I think, beyond the chair, there's some fantastic people involved in the Federation 100%. And think in a different way, you know, compared to what I can remember 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. And that's not a slight. It's just that we had to modernise, come
exactly
up to date and not really just sit here for threatening to sue Met Aaron because they said it's a charity coming from the Northwest. No harm in that. And I think it's a great story, right? Do you remember that one?
Vaguely, yeah.
Well, I'm saying we're looking at things a little bit different now. And as I say, I don't mean that as a dig because it was a cracking story at the time. Carolyn Murray, Director and General Manager of the Shandon Hotel and Spa at Marble Hill and the new Chair of the Donegal Irish Hotels Federation. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you,
Greg. Thanks. Aoife joins me now. And Aoife, I really appreciate you coming on because we don't have enough time, but we only have a minute or two. But just to offset this notion that GPs worked harder in the past than they do now, you know, right? You're a family of GPs. What say you?
Yeah, I totally agree. Where that message probably came through from, it was probably somebody who is very frustrated trying to get through to doctor surgery, just like myself. I'm no different to anybody else. But it was just the fact that I know myself, my granddad was a GP, both my parents were GPs, both retired. And I actually have a sibling as well that is also a GP. And I just thought it was very interesting, you know, they were saying that GPs back in the day, they would have worked until 11 o'clock at night. Totally agree with that. I remember my granddad, I remember people arriving at the door, and it was, you know, it would have been, I suppose it would have been easier access to the people and they would never, ever have seen a person stuck. My own parents as well were the same. I do remember my mum having to work every second night on call before, long before now doc was ever a thing. But I look now at where my brother is. You know, he's a GP as well. He's got a very young family. And don't get me wrong, he works extremely long hours as well behind closed doors. You know, the bits that people don't see when they're trying to catch up in paperwork and things like that. I, for one, am delighted that they don't have to work those extremely long hours. Otherwise, I don't think we get people like Dr. Kieran O'Flaherty into the job.
Yeah, I think you're
and
right.
A lot of friends of mine who did go down to the road, you know, and decided to go into medicine themselves. I myself didn't go into medicine purely because I saw what my granddad went through. But yeah, I know, ironic, what my parents went through. And now I'm so delighted to see my brother actually taking up the mantle. But he has a totally different work ethic. He realises what works, what does not work.
Yeah.
And you do have to have that work-life balance. He also has a fantastic wife. who kind of will support him in that role as well. And I think if you have the support, if you have seen it yourself, you're kind of going to yourself, do you know what, is this really the job for me?
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes with nurses and GPs, we think it's a devotion and expect more rather than your brother being a family man, trying to help his community, trying to have time with his family and strike that balance. Aoife, I wish I had more time. I really appreciate your time. Can I ask what you ended up doing, and is it easier than being a GP, or is that too personal?
Oh, I don't know if it's easier, but it's certainly a vocation. I'm a primary school teacher, and I absolutely love it. Okay. And in saying that, I still thought for a very long time about going into medicine.
Right.
But I do believe that teaching was the better way for me.
These are all suckers for punishment, maybe. Okay.
Just love it. Thank you, Greg.
Aoife, listen, thanks for the work that you do, and thanks for giving us that angle and insight. That's what I love about the show. Look after yourself. That's Aoife. When I was over in, we went to Lanzarote, play a Blanca. Quite nice, actually. Lovely time. We had a fantastic time as a family. Bumped into a lovely family from Letterkenny at the poolside. Me with my moobs out, but it's grand. So it's funny. You can travel to the feels like the other end of the earth, and you see local people. And two lovely ladies who I didn't get their names, chatting to them in section 16 outside the airport. They'd just been to Italy and were getting the McGinley coach home too. So it was lovely to see them. And it's just astonishing. You know, no matter where you go, you bump into people that you know, it's or they know you, whichever combination is. So it's lovely. It's a nice wee thing to happen. I love it. And love getting a chat too. And I love chatting to people. And we had nice conversations, albeit fleeting, with the family from Letterkenny. Right, that's where we leave it on the show today. Great to be back. Have a fantastic Monday.